Okay, I'm just going to switch on, just increasing the volume on my speaker so I can hear you a bit better. Right,
Well,
well,
it's
is it
May the 27th,
2020?
2020.
We're going to talk about the Vietnam War.
Yes. And I rather made the running last time, but this time it's up to you to put forward the main dogma. Well, not dog. No. The propositions that we're going to be
Proposition.
talking about. Yeah.
Okay, well, my proposition is that the narrative we are so constantly fed about Vietnam is almost entirely wrong.
Right. Now, in what, first of all, in what way is this narrative wrong?
The narrative is, I think the key point about the narrative is it's about an unwinnable war,
Yes.
when in fact, by 1972, America had actually pretty much won. Well, it hadn't won in the sense that the North Vietnamese weren't still trying to invade the South or take it over, but they got to a stage where they could stop them. I mean, they defeated the Viet Cong, for instance, pretty much. And so it was only regular troops that the North Vietnamese could use. And they got to the stage where, with the use of the South Vietnamese army and US air power, the North Vietnamese could be stopped. And this did happen in the Easter Offensive of 1972. And had Congress continued to back it, there is no reason to think that South Vietnam would eventually would have survived and prospered in much the same way that Taiwan or South Korea did. Instead, it was invaded by the North, taken over, and I don't think it's any exaggeration to say that millions of people died as a consequence. And that's very
Well, certainly
sad.
the aftermath of what actually happened was frightful in Laos and Cambodia, as well as in actually somewhat less so in Vietnam, but it had already been very bad there. But in Cambodia, it was spectacular, wasn't it?
Well, that's a third of the population died.
Yeah,
I don't think
yeah.
it's a third in Vietnam, but it may have been a similar number, actually. You think about the whole business of the boat people. You think why people are clambering into rickety boats, and the estimate is half of them drowned trying to escape.
Yes.
Well, I think the implication is that it was pretty awful, the conditions in
And
Vietnam.
let me be clear what this victory consists of. It's a divided Vietnam in much the same way as Korea was divided, with a front line which the Americans were committed to defending in perpetuity.
Well, yes. I mean, the front line was not quite as simple. It's not like the Western Front line, for instance. It varied a bit, and certainly in the Paris Peace Accords, the Americans accepted that the North Vietnamese would have, the already occupied parts of South Vietnam.
Let's clear some dates. 70, the Paris Accords, that was 72, was it, or 73?
Right at the end of 72, and I think it
Right.
was signed in 73, so yeah.
And the collapse of the South Vietnamese regime happened in 75.
Yes.
And the intervention by the Americans began in, was it 55?
Well, in terms
After the collapse of the
of.
French effort to subdue Vietnam, or to retain possession of Vietnam, or
Well,
something.
yes, it probably started before then in terms of
Dien
money and
Bien
arms.
Phu. Dien Bien Phu was the big disaster for the French, and that was 54, was it?
Yeah, thereabouts, yes.
And the Americans took up the slack from the French, basically.
Yeah. But they didn't, the combat troops didn't enter until 1965.
Yeah. I think the key to it is how many Americans would have been committed to defending South Vietnam indefinitely. Because that was the thing that was ripped away, wasn't it, in 73, the Americans left,
Yes,
following the Paris Peace Accords. And at that point, the North Vietnamese.
well, actually, no. There's two parts to this. There is the withdrawal of U.S. ground troops, and that was completed by the end of 1972, and then the POWs came home. But actually, at that stage, not much happened. The real killer for South Vietnam was when Congress voted, and this is by a large majority, by the way, to reduce funding for South Vietnam and to forbid American air power to be used.
Yes.
And at that point, it was they were in a lot of trouble.
So as far as you're concerned, that decision is the one that really destroyed what the Americans could have done.
Yes. That is absolutely that
it wasn't the Paris Peace Accords.
Not to me. I mean, there are, you know, South Vietnamese, you know, old soldiers who will tell you actually it was the Paris Peace Accords because it allowed North Vietnam to occupy part of South Vietnam. Mm. I'm not so sure about that. Yeah, that may have been a big blow to them, certainly. I can understand why Nixon and Kissinger were keen to get out of that. And perhaps, you know, in much the same way that, you know, we have, you know, in getting out of the European Union, we essentially put a border in the RSC. I mean, I'm not happy about that, but, you know, it may be the situation where you just want to get out and you think, well...
And Nixon and Kissinger were very disappointed by the congressional vote, were they? So their policy...
I don't know. Well, actually, think about it. Yeah, actually, it must have happened under Nixon's watch, so I'm pretty sure. I mean, there were a few congressional votes, but I think the key one, and I'll have to look this up, was Case Church, and I'm pretty sure that was 1973. But, of course, Nixon didn't go until August 1974, so I suspect that actually a lot of his... The North Vietnamese were scared of Nixon. Not to put too fine a point on it, I think they had a lot of respect for him and felt no matter what that silly Congress
so might
do.
Nixon going in 1974 preceded the collapse of South Vietnam.
Yes.
And so therefore the attempt to get Nixon for what by current standards were rather trifling peccadilloes is all part of this story.
We ought to talk about Watergate later, but anyway, yeah.
Well, it's part of the story because it did for Nixon, and if as you say, they rated Nixon as an enemy, maybe if Watergate hadn't happened, the Vietnam War wouldn't have been lost.
You do wonder. You do wonder. What have he done when the North Vietnamese started to attack in 1975? Would they have attacked? I think they would have done, actually, because they were sort of pretty committed to the idea of a one Vietnam under communist rule. So, but you don't think that Nixon would have allowed it to happen somehow. He's a clever guy, and he got his way with the North Vietnamese up to that point. So,
something I didn't appreciate until I did a bit of homework for this was that the Chinese and the Vietnamese were not best buddies by the end of this, because at the end of it, the Vietnamese deposed the Cambodian regime, which was still being supported by the Chinese, which is not something you hear talked about a huge amount.
Well,
but I mean, it's in the Wikipedia version of events, so it's not being suppressed. But
well, I mean, China invaded Vietnam at that point.
Yes,
not for
exactly.
very long. And it's a bit mysterious as to why they did it and what they were trying to do. The Vietnamese occupation of Cambodia has been described as a Vietnam's Vietnam, in that they were there for a very long time and they didn't achieve a great deal, and they lost a lot of men as well.
Mm.
But obviously it's a communist regime, so they're not going to be entirely honest about this.
Excuse me. Yeah. I mean, the reason I'm asking all the questions is because I have been, maybe woefully, but certainly I have been, ignorant of the details of the Vietnam War from the moment it got underway until now.
Yeah. And when I phoned you up about this, I was incredibly surprised, actually. I thought everyone, teenager, 20-something in the 60s, was absolutely obsessed by Vietnam, but you weren't.
I don't remember. I turned up for one demo, but I think that expressed indifference rather than obsession. Indifference is as the feeling that, you know, what are we doing supporting this? What are we trying to accomplish? The memory I have of the time of Lyndon Johnson making speeches on television and then Nixon was that the Americans never clarified their purpose. And for that reason, their tactics went haywire. When you aren't clear about what you're trying to accomplish.
I thought their purpose was clear enough to preserve South Vietnam. Am I wrong about that? Or?
Well, I'm saying this was my impression. I got the impression, especially with LBJ, I got the impression that he didn't... It's one thing to sort of say, we're going to resist communism, which is what he did say, but you need a sort of page of A4 explaining exactly how. Are you going to...
A strategy.
Yes. I mean, the Korean War, for example, resulted in a process of resisting communism in the sense that South Korea remained a free and capitalistic sort of place and has done pretty well. And thereby, by example, showed up communism for the economic failure that it was. Well, now, was that the thing they were trying to achieve this time around? You say they were pretty clear about that. But, I mean, were there not thoughts in some of the generals' heads to invade North Vietnam?
I believe one of the South Vietnamese high command wanted to take a bit of North Vietnam just to show that they could. And to make it a bit more even. And that strikes me as a very perfectly eminently sensible thing to do.
Well, MacArthur did that, didn't he?
Yes.
The Incheon landings took place in North Korea, didn't they?
And I thought what it was now. We can check on that. Yes.
Well, the point was he basically surrounded the North Korean army.
Oh, yes. And that respect, yes.
At which point the Chinese bashed in.
They surrounded the North Vietnam, North Koreans. The North Koreans retreated more or less up to the border with China. At which point the Chinese came in. I mean, there may be a gap of a year in these events. So.
What I'm getting at is that, for what little it may be worth, my impression at the time was the Americans didn't know what they were doing, and I concluded from that they should stop doing it.
Hmm.
Because are unforgivable.
I mean, they had this idea, I can't remember what it was called, but it's essentially the doctrine of, slow escalation. You know, if the North Vietnamese do something, you do something back. And the bigger the North Vietnamese outrage, the bigger your retaliation. And I don't think maybe that's what you're talking about. I mean, they had this idea of the president... nominating targets, deciding what was going to be bombed in 1965. Maybe that's what you meant.
That sort of thing didn't seem to me at all clear what they were trying to accomplish with that.
Oh, right.
And it doesn't seem to have worked. I mean, the North Vietnamese remained absolutely unswerving in their desire to conquer the whole of Vietnam.
Yeah.
And they duly did. And none of this game theory stuff impressed them at all. They weren't playing those games at all.
No. I mean, this actually reminds me of, and I hope this isn't too much of a tangent, but I was recently reading Richard Pipes' book about the Russian Revolution, and the thing that really struck me about this was Lenin's single-mindedness and his commitment to a socialist Russia. Yeah. And this took a lot of people by surprise. Even other socialists didn't get this, that he was prepared to kill millions of people to get what he wanted. And he was not joking, and they thought he was, and they all ended up dead.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing like having a really clear objective. If the other fellows don't have a clear objective, you've got a much better chance of winning. I mean, think of the Romans confronting Carthage. What was it? Carthago Delendar Est. Yes. I don't know whether that's how you pronounce it, but that was it. And was it Cato? He just kept on saying, we're going to destroy these people. We're going to wreck Carthage and sow the land with salt. Well, that's an objective. You may not like it, but it's an objective. And in the Second World War, and we talked about this last week apropos the bombing offensive, the objective was unconditional surrender. That the Germans would simply do as they were told.
Yes.
There wouldn't be any negotiations. There would simply be them saying, I surrender.
Yes.
All of them. And again, it means you achieve it. I mean, it probably arguably that prolonged the Second World War, but it meant that it got won.
Yeah, and there was no question about it after that, and there's no second goes or third goes at this.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder how that would apply to Vietnam, or it could be applied to Vietnam. I mean, you could have the strategies like, we are going to invade North Vietnam and unify Vietnam under Southern control.
That would have made sense. Yeah. And some of the things Johnson said suggested that would have made sense. You know, that's what he was wanting to do.
Oh, really?
Of course, the implication that communism was going to be defeated, what the hell that meant exactly wasn't clear, you know? I mean, this is very subjective on my part, in the sense that I watched Johnson give speeches on the TV and I heard different big shot Americans explaining what they thought they were doing, and I formed the impression that nobody had cracked the whip and imposed half a paragraph that they were all going to agree on and do.
I mean,
And I had the very strong feeling even then that America was immensely powerful, and if they'd done that, they would have achieved it.
My understanding is, and this is based on a few YouTubes here and there, and it could be wrong, is that they were very, I mean, even Johnson was very reluctant to get involved in the first place, and he was terrified of getting the Chinese involved.
Yes.
Maybe this has something to do with Korea again, in that they were...
I think you could be pretty sure it has. I mean, the experience of the Chinese crashing over the Yalu River, that really left its mark on the Americans.
Yeah. Although they stopped stopped the Chinese there, and by 1953, as I understand, it was pretty much a stalemate, so...
Yeah, but the Americans weren't happy with stalemates at that point in their military careers, were they?
Is that right? I don't know.
Well, I don't think they liked the idea. I mean, MacArthur was famously sacked, wasn't he, for wanting to go all the way. I mean, what strikes me about the Korean War is that the Americans did impose a very clear regime on the events that they were faced with. And they never did that in Vietnam.
Hmm.
Never managed to do it.
I mean, I suppose in the case of Korea, they weren't facing something like a Viet Cong, although that was all North Vietnamese. It would be very difficult for the North Koreans to supply a guerrilla army in South Korea.
Well, am I right in thinking that Korea is geographically a completely different sort of place to Vietnam?
Well, it's all hilly, isn't it? I mean, it does have jungles.
I mean, it's Second World War country, isn't it?
I mean, I know I said earlier I thought that the jungle had a large part to do with it. I'm beginning to wonder if that's true. Given the success the Americans had in destroying the Viet Cong, which is a secret of the war, but as I understand it, they did
it,
or less. And given that that meant the North Vietnamese had to use their regular troops, I wonder if it wasn't a lot more similar, if actually the jungle wasn't as big a factor as we think.
Yes.
I don't know about that, and it's maybe something, extra research is needed. But I wonder if actually they had, by 1972, made it far more like South Korea than it had, 5 years previously.
Yes, I find that persuasive. That's a good question to bring to further research, as it were, isn't it?
Yeah.
Here's another angle on all this, which is that what happened during the 1960s was that the American left changed radically.
Yes.
They had been, don't forget, they'd been FDR, the president who brought America into the Second World War and won it. Truman had got a grip on the Korean War, and there was no suggestion of... America being somehow the less good side, behaving barbarously in Korea. But by the 1960s, the left changed its attitude towards America, well, to put it bluntly, chucking its weight around in foreign countries. It became split and willing to oppose it, let's put it that way, if it didn't feel it was going well. And hence you get these congressional votes and also all the demonstrating and the draft card burning and all this kind of thing.
Well, I wonder how... Yes, I think the draft is a big factor. I wonder how well they'd have done without that. Because if you're going to conscript people with a possibility they might die, then it's got to be for a jolly good reason.
Yes, and we come back to this thing of a jolly good reason, which they clearly felt they weren't being given.
Really? Golly.
Well, don't you think?
No.
I mean, wasn't the question they were asking all the time, what are we doing there? Why are we being sent there?
I mean, you say that, and I think, can I think of a clear statement, either by Johnson or indeed Nixon, about what the purpose of the war was? And I can't, or not that I'm particularly familiar with their speeches on this. But, you're referring to what I said earlier on. I thought the idea was that you allowed South Vietnam to make its own choice about whether it's going to be communist or not.
Well, that's quite different from America saying it wasn't going to allow South Vietnam, to go communist. I mean, I've been reading Max Hastings a little bit. He's written a whole book about the Vietnam War, which I haven't read. But I've just read a chapter in his book called Warriors about this extraordinary American character called John Paul Vann.
Mm-hmm.
And the story he tells is of an American press corps in the 50s and early 60s that were very supportive of the Vietnam effort, but turned against it because they came to the conclusion that instead of making friends with the Vietnamese, the Americans were simply killing them. That was it. Their tactics were completely 180 degrees wrong. They were trying to kill the Viet Cong, and they didn't care who got in the way. That seemed to be a politer way of putting it.
I mean, I suppose it's a question of to what degree do you trust the press corps? We are talking in the midst of a battle between the government and the press corps.
Well, they've
here.
Changed a lot since then, I think. As I say, these people were... America was much more profoundly united in, say, 1955 than it is now, isn't it? Wasn't it?
To the best of my knowledge, yes.
I don't think these people had it in for America, in inverted commas, the way seemingly the entire Democrat Party does now. They wanted America to do well.
I'm surprised, actually.
Them is Max Halberstam, I think.
Yeah.
And the other is Paul Sheehan, who wrote Paul Sheehan's an Australian cricketer. Forgive both of them. Yes, Sheehan wrote a book about John Paul Vann called A Bright Shining Lie or something like that. Mm. In other words, he became utterly disillusioned with this chap and on a larger scale with the entire American war effort. So in other words, the left in America were making serious criticisms of what the Americans were doing in Vietnam.
We're assuming that the journalists mean left, are we?
Well, I don't think they were so easily describable as left-wing. I think they're more like Max Hastings himself. I don't think he's totally conventionally left-wing, is he? I don't think so.
He's editor of the Telegraph for long enough.
Yeah, but he's very critical of the American conduct of the Vietnam War. And by the end, he says, as you know, to quote your phrase, unwinnable. So, I mean, he basically created or reinforced the narrative that you referred to right at the beginning of this.
Hmm.
And his picture is, as I say, by the way, he regards the South Vietnamese as just almost comically unwilling to make any attempt to resist the communists or communism.
I think this is one of those things where it varies. I mean, let's face it. I mean, the American part of this war was 10 years on, and it goes through phases.
Mm.
And I suspect, the South Vietnamese fought the North Vietnamese in 1972, okay, with American support, but they beat them. You know, there were disasters along the way, but there were far bigger disasters for the North Vietnamese. So the evidence, as I know it, and maybe there are people out there who know a lot more about this than I do, is that actually, if it's true that the South Vietnamese army wasn't much cop in, say, 1966, things were different in 1972. And let's face it, you know, the British Army wasn't much cop in 1914, but it was very good in 1918. So, you know, things can change.
Yeah.
You know, given a bit of money and training and experience. And when the North Vietnamese did invade in 1975, there were huge numbers of refugees. Why were there huge numbers of refugees? Because they were darn scared of what the North Vietnamese were going to do to them, which suggests... Now, you know, if that is, that fear exists, then there is a certain pressure within Vietnamese society for people to join the army and do a good job there, I would have thought.
Well,
that doesn't mean they're any good at it, but they mean to have the morale and motivation to do it.
Yes. Well, it's certain, another thing, and which Hastings is very clear about, is that the early American leadership during the war was absurd. I mean, just crazy. Body count.
I'm going to defend body count. The strategy, Westmoreland's strategy, was that what he wanted to do was get to a point where he had killed, where he was killing the enemy at a faster rate than he could be replaced. It's not completely stupid. If you can get to that point, you are going to win.
That they killed just people rather than communists. That's what was claimed at the time and ever since. And that the body count made no distinctions in practice between communists and just people who got in the way.
I'll make a case for it. I mean, I think, first of all, the shadow of Mille Eye is, well, casts a long, big shadow over all this, but it appears to be, if not a one-off, a rare event. So I think... My prejudice is that the Americans killed a lot of far fewer civilians than we think, and far fewer than the North Vietnamese were doing and the Viet Cong were doing. The other point is the Tet Offensive is it's revealing. Although it was the turning point of the war.
Date of this?
January 1968. It was a... the point about it was that the North Vietnamese are getting a bit nervous. They were beginning to think that the Americans were winning, so they had this huge offensive, and they thought the South Vietnamese were going to join in and join them as liberators. So they were wrong on that count, and they suffered huge losses as a consequence. Unfortunately, it was spun by the media as demonstrating that America wasn't winning, when actually it probably was. That's not to say that Americans didn't do a lot better in the years subsequent to that, but I suspect that Westmoreland, this is the guy who's in charge at the time, was a lot better than we think.
I've had enough experience of arguing with people about all sorts of things to know that I shouldn't completely surrender ever. And I do find it persuasive that the Americans might have won. But I think their mistakes began and became thoroughly dug in quite a long time before, say, 1974. You know, they were making a lot of mistakes throughout the war. Basically, they talked about winning hearts and minds, but they didn't actually get organized to do it. I mean, I'm thinking, how would the British, who won the Malaysian emergency, have conducted themselves in Vietnam?
I mean, this is...
I suggest very differently.
I mean, this is the thing about the counter-narrative, is that there is the claim, actually, they were winning hearts and minds. I think it was revealing that, as I understand it, when American veterans go back to Vietnam, they are welcomed with open arms.
Yes.
Yes, because American involvement is associated with good times. And, you know, for every Mille Eye, you would have dozens of cases where... platoons would enter a village, and they would they get the medic out, and they do a bit of free healthcare and stuff like this. So I'm not quite sure that's the case. I mean, but we have to balance it with the sheer thuggery of the Viet Cong,
yes,
who had no compunction about killing thousands of people if they got the chance. So. What's my point I'm going to make? I suspect that the Americans are a lot more popular than we think.
Were much more the Americans could have done better with them without, and arguably did do better than they're said to have done with them.
Yeah.
That's the point, isn't it? Yeah.
I mean, I think that the problem is a lot of this is because the media lives by narratives, and there were a sufficiently large number of left-wing people in the media who wanted to spin a left-wing narrative, and once they got a narrative of dead civilians and quagmire and, you know, unwinnable war and what are we doing, they could run with it, and it stuck to that, to the extent that of the disaster of 1973 when Congress voted by large majorities to
73 was it that
yeah,
vote
I think so yeah. Yeah, abandon South Vietnam.
I am strongly persuaded by what you said, more so than I expected to be, actually. I don't know why.
Okay.
Sorry, that's a bit of a backhander, isn't it?
I'm persuading Brian. Well, I should sit on my laurels in that case.
the other thing we should mention is the domino theory. That was also one of the big arguments about this, that this is also what the Americans said they were doing. They were stopping the first domino falling. And it is true, as we discussed sort of 20 minutes ago, that two big dominoes in the form of Laos and Cambodia also fell in the aftermath of the fall of the Vietnamese domino.
But
that was it.
But not Thailand, not Malaysia, Indonesia or Singapore, which
exactly.
I think was the other worry.
Exactly.
And
yes.
I believe that Lee Kuan Yew, the Prime Minister of Singapore for a long time, said that actually those 10 years of the Vietnam War made a huge difference because it allowed them to get themselves ready and sort things out. I hadn't made the connection before. Have you ever seen that, what's that film, The Year of Living Dangerously, which is set in Indonesia at the time of a communist uprising? Obviously, you haven't seen that one, okay? It's got Mel Gibson and Sigourney Weaver in it.
I think I did see it, but didn't pay proper attention to it. I didn't even realise where it was happening, I don't think.
But the point is there was a situation in the 60s where Indonesia could have gone communist quite easily, but it didn't. So, this is one of those ex post facto justifications, like we were talking about last week with the bomber offensive, that okay, the Vietnam War didn't go quite as according to plan, but actually,
stabilized all these other countries. Accomplished something, nevertheless.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm dubious about that, but maybe it's true. Maybe it's true. And if Lee Kuan Yew thinks so, I think there's a good chance it is true.
Counts for something, doesn't it?
It does.
Yes. I mean, you've got to think that that postponing the fall of Vietnam accomplished something. How much is not clear, but something, you would have thought.
Well, we're never going to know. So, maybe.
But that was a very interesting way of looking at the Vietnam War, because it was a big deal at the time. People talked about that. I remember a lot, and I remember after the fall of those three countries, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, that I remember thinking, well, this is when there are supposed to be some more dominoes falling, but it didn't happen.
You never really got the feeling that Thailand was about to go, because that's the next one along, isn't it?
I don't remember which one was the next in line. I just remember thinking, aren't there supposed to be more dominoes, according to what the domino theorists had said? It would appear that it wasn't that straightforward, I mean, the point is that Laos and Cambodia are right next to Vietnam, aren't they, physically?
Yes.
And the Viet Cong had been using Cambodia and Laos as bases to fight their war.
Yeah.
And then the North Vietnamese did the same. So they were...
I point something out is that the Viet Cong was an entirely North Vietnamese creation.
Ah.
Oh, you didn't know that?
Well, I mean, it was... It was supposedly South... I mean, there were South Vietnamese people in it, were there not?
I'm sure there were. I'm sure there were. But in terms of its weaponry and its structure and its orders, they all came from Hanoi.
Yes. Well, that would fit with their overall strategy, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Their overall purpose. They weren't going to have an independent South Vietnam ruled by different communists, were they? That wasn't at all the plan.
No. My understanding is that when Saigon fell in 1975, the first thing the North Vietnamese did was arrest all the Viet Cong leaders.
Yes.
Which kind of makes the point. Mm. No, you're not going to be any part of this. Yeah, we're in charge.
But the reason the domino theory interests me is, well, there are many reasons, but one is that this all these catastrophes for the Americans were followed by Ronald Reagan breezing into Washington and with a smile on his face and saying, well, we're going to win this thing. You know, he was asked what he thought about the Cold War, and he said, well, my plan is this. We win, they lose.
Did he actually say that?
He did.
Did he say it publicly? Oh, you heard it. Right, okay.
I believe so.
I'd love to find that.
That was his plan.
And, I know you talked about the evil empire and things like that, but I didn't know he said that. I was sort of, you know, growing up in the whole of the 70s, but I mean, I was very, very conscious of what was going on in the late 70s. And it wasn't just, I mean, after Vietnam, there was also Angola and Mozambique.
There were all kinds of hot spots around the world where the Russians were making a nuisance of themselves.
And Afghanistan, of course, crucially. And you got the impression we were losing. So maybe this, you know, Reagan was a reaction to all that happening.
Mm. You see, I didn't. I always felt that in terms of Southeast Asia, the glass was at least half full. You had, on the one hand, the catastrophes we've talked about, but also, simultaneously, you had the Asian tigers racing ahead economically. Hong Kong, there were four of them, weren't there? Hong Kong, South Korea, Taiwan, and...
Japan?
Well, to say nothing of Japan. I meant the little ones, you know, the little...
I think Macau is too small for this, isn't it?
Singapore? Anyway, the point is that it may well be the case that communism was swallowing up lots of places, but it sure as hell wasn't doing them any good. Whereas the countries that, through either luck or determination or a mixture, had stayed capitalist were doing just fabulously well. I mean, they were like the poster boys for capitalism all over the world, weren't they, those countries?
At what point? I mean, my memory is certainly by the 70s, the Japanese were, you know, destroying everyone, wiping out everyone. I mean, I can think of all the Japanese goods that ended up at home.
Yeah.
But weren't places like South Korea and, well, South Korea a bit later? I mean, it's the 80s before I think they really emerged. And, of course, much later before they started overtaking the Japanese.
Well, Hong Kong was a very big deal
then. Oh, yes, made in Hong Kong, yes.
And those sort of, you were starting to see these pictures of amazing assemblages of skyscrapers. Clearly there was, you know, the good life was being had. See, I can remember 20 years before then being told by socialists at universities that capitalism was just nothing but sweatshops and misery. And what the Asian Tiger guys were saying at the time was just, you wait and see. And that's what I said to the socialists. And 20 years later, I was still saying, now you've seen. Now what do you think?
Well,
and they didn't have an answer. They didn't have an answer. The answer of the socialists was to turn their backs on the whole argument and say that economic development is evil. It ruins the weather, you know. They didn't straightforwardly surrender. Yes. That never happens. But they did change their tune in a major way and became economic pessimists and said, well, so what? It's all tawdry rubbish and, you know, lots of neon signs and crap and everybody obsessed with money and losing their spiritual values and all this kind of nonsense. And that also happened in Southeast Asia. It wasn't just Vietnam. There was a mixed story. And of the two, the good news struck me as more important than the bad news.
Really?
Because the good news went to the question of why the Cold War should be won.
Yes.
All that the Vietnam story showed was that it could be lost if we fluffed our lines and had the wrong tactics and had lots of lying journalists crawling all over everything, as you say. But the conclusion I drew from it was certainly not that communism was going to wrap up the world, you know.
I was going to suggest that you mentioned lying journalists, and I was thinking to myself, well, actually, maybe we won despite the lying journalists. I mean, what was your take on where the media stood in the last decade of the Cold War?
Yes, we won despite them.
That's interesting.
They were objectively pro-Soviet.
Really?
That's what I thought.
Right. That's interesting. I didn't get that impression. Certainly in the late 70s.
I don't mean by that they, if you asked them, do you want the USSR to conquer the world, they would have said yes, with a bright smile all over their face. I meant that the things, that what they were was anti-anti-communist. That's what they were.
Trying to get my head around that one.
Well, anti-anti-communist. Well, yes. Is objectively pro-communist, but it's not subjectively pro-communism. They want the USSR to become a nicer, sweeter, more friendly place, but anything that actually accomplishes that, they don't like it. That's what an anti-anti-communist is. And I despise them as much as I despised communists, because they weren't honest about what they wanted. They were dishonest. They lied to themselves as well as to the rest of them.
They wanted Russia to be a nicer place, but they didn't want anything to support anything that would actually
would do that. They were against it, and of course they were appalled by Ronald Reagan. I don't see the left as the same thing all the time. I see, yes, there were communists who were, you know, evil manipulators from the get go, but the American left during the Second World War was pro-American, you know, but by the end of the 20th century, they'd stopped being pro-American in any sort of recognisably gung-ho-ish kind of sense.
I'm trying to think what we mean by the left here. I mean, when I look at what McCarthy was up against, I mean, he's up against real proper dyed-in-the-wool communists. And that's the sort of people. I mean, are we talking about a different sort of left from that?
I think the left has become more numerous, less bookish, more religious, actually, in a funny kind of way. But there are more people involved in it, and I don't know. It always seemed to me that by the 80s they were.
I mean, let me put it this:
the Cold War.
Are there people who you think would exemplify? What you mean by you're talking about left but not communist? Is that
well? They didn't. They were left but not communist. The people who, in say 1950, well, John F. Kennedy would be an example of left but not communist. You know,
but he was
and some would say not left.
Thoroughgoing Cold Warrior was John F. Kennedy, right? Okay.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, he took America into this thing, didn't he?
He also reduced taxes, I believe. But there you go.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but, I mean, it's difficult to think of anyone in the Democrat Party who would be like that nowadays, isn't it? I mean, I'm struggling to think of Kennedy. Is he particularly left-wing? What did he do that was left-wing? I suppose he had something to do with civil rights.
Well, he had campaigns against Republicans is what he had. That's what made him left-wing. And the you know, for practical purposes, that's what they had, and they went with it.
Anything
in
else,
that sense, the atmosphere on the left seems to me to have changed a lot.
In that,
well, they became less. I mean, Kennedy loathed communism. By the 90s, by the 80s, they were, as I say, anti-anti-communist. I think describes it very well. By the same token, the Republicans seem to me to have reverted to a pre-World War II type, which is Americanism in one country, in the person of Donald Trump. There was a very interesting, I heard a very interesting interview somebody did with Rand Paul, where I think it was Rubin, who asked him, what do you make of Trump? You know, is he as bad as you feared? Is he as good as you hoped? Or is he better than you hoped? Or worse than you feared? Or what? He said, well, the one thing where he really had been agreeably pleased by Trump and somewhat surprised was his instinctive desire not to crash into other countries and tell them what's what.
Yeah,
he wanted to get out of that sort of thing. And I think in that sense he's a return to what the Republicans were like in the interwar period in between the two world wars. They were the people Roosevelt had to outmaneuver to get America into the Second World War. And Trump is much more instinctively a get the boys home kind of president. I don't think he's You get the feeling that, like Nixon, he would have preferred not to get them home at any cost. I mean, he's quite good at threatening other things besides warfare. He's very clever at that. And libertarians hate him for that reason, because he often uses threats of trade restrictions to get his enemies to be frightened of him. And he also uses Twitter to create a general atmosphere of unpredictability, which again is a very good technique for winning fights with people if they don't know what you're going to do next and are frightened of it.
Yes, yes. Is anyone actually frightened of Trump? I mean, I know we're straying off topic here, but...
Well, I think the Iranians have calmed down considerably. I think that they've made all sorts of threats, which they haven't carried out.
Well, it's interesting, to see how quickly Black Lives Matter disappeared after Trump came into power.
Maybe I'm talking personal impressions rather than fact. I'm giving you a personal narrative, you might say. This all comes back to the domino theory and why America didn't just win the Cold War, but almost bounced back and won the Cold War in one, it was almost as a sort of direct reaction to the Vietnam War. It was almost like that. You know, most Americans are saying, well, this is terrible, we're doomed, we're going to go downhill from now on. And Reagan said, no, we're not. And while we're about it, we're going to beat those Ruskies, you know, or the Russian communists. He was very careful about not calling them Russians. Not calling the Russians enemies. He wanted to make sure it was the communists who were enemies.
Yeah.
Which was a major strategic clarification.
I mean, it's strange, isn't it? I mean, I can't remember Reagan or any American politician at the time referring to Vietnam. It was almost as if it was airbrushed from history.
Yeah.
Even very, very shortly afterwards.
Exactly. That's what was so odd about it. It didn't depress them nearly as much as you'd think it should have, if you see what I mean. I think we should say that it depressed the people who fought in it greatly, because it's one thing to fight a war and get hurt and watch your friends being killed. It's quite another to come home and be told you were wasting your time again and again by lots of people. That must be a pretty depressing
There are YouTubes out there of you know, Vietnam vets who feel they did a good thing and I'm very proud of what they did, and if I met I'd shake his hand because I think they did they did everything they could, and they did what they were asked of, and it was a good thing and a noble cause. Mm. So,
and it's war, so mistakes get made. Yeah,
that's part of it.
Yeah. Right. Well, are there? Do you want to add more? I think I've asked all the questions I was, and made all the points I was wanting to sort of. Prod you with, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, there was a sort of question I had, and you know, we were talking about this move by Congress, which is decisive. It's an absolutely decisive move to withdraw funding from the South Vietnam and not allow American aircraft to get involved. And the fact that it's a huge majority, I find huge. You know, it's clearly significant. So why? So I constantly ask myself, why did it happen? Is it incompetence or is it mendacity? Or is it the fact that...
One question I've still got in my head, and I haven't been able to get an answer from reading the reading I've managed to do in between us choosing to do this and now doing it, is was there anything to the sort of larger global strategy involved of not pissing off the Chinese?
As far as I'm aware, no.
It's surprising how little that seems to get mentioned in summaries of the Vietnam War by people who you'd think would mention it if it was germane. People like Kissinger, for example. I read briefly some of his book called Grand Strategy, I think, and he didn't sort of clarify that this was a big deal. It was kind of implied. But as you say, the most remarkable thing was the way that he talked about Vietnam and then suddenly he stopped and started talking about a whole different kind of contest, and that was that, you know. Oh well, move on we go. It was extraordinary, that sort of oh well, these things happen kind of attitude.
Well, I suppose you get to a point where you have to have that attitude or else you go mad if you're too emotionally involved with it. And there is a sort of, everything I know about Nixon and Kissinger suggests that there was an emotional detachment about it, and after all, it wasn't their war. They didn't start it. They just were picking up the pieces.
Well, it was Democrat presidents who got it started.
Yeah.
Have any Democrat presidents started any wars lately? I mean, Obama's accused of doing all kinds of skullduggery things in the Middle East, but he didn't start all that, did he?
No.
That was Bush. Bush Jr. Bush, both of them.
Did he get involved in Syria at all? Because that would have been on his watch.
Well, I think when you inherit a war, you often find yourself doing some pretty warlike stuff, but you wouldn't have done it in the first place. You know, we don't start from here kind of attitude. Except that you do when, you know, whatever's on your desk is what you have to deal with. But I don't think Obama, would he have started lots of wars in the Middle East? He's accused of having tremendous preferences for this brand of Muslim over that brand, for basically being pro-Iranian. So would he have started wars against Iran's enemies? I don't know.
Apart from Syria, wasn't he also involved in Libya in some way? I don't know, I wasn't paying attention.
Yes, there was a big. There were lots of big interventions there, weren't there?
Actually, this is a sort of horrible thought I've been having, is that if it was the case that a narrative got established in Vietnam of defeat when actually victory was achieved, maybe that's what's happening in Iraq at the moment. I mean, it's years since I've even looked at the situation because I've been sort of bogged down by that narrative, but maybe things are a lot better than we think.
Yes, could well be. I mean, my big prejudice about all of this is that the Americans can't create nations out of nothing. You know, they can't. And maybe the big one that got them thinking they could was South Korea. Maybe that was the big one. Japan and South Korea, but especially South Korea. But maybe that's wrong. Maybe the Americans can create nations if they're patient and careful and determined enough.
I mean, my assumption is, my belief is that South Korea is pretty homogenous. And I'm not sure that would be, I'm quite sure that's not true of Iraq, with the Kurds and the Marsh Arabs and people like that. South Vietnam, I mean, well, the fact that I think all leaders of Vietnam, South or North, believed there was one Vietnam, I think is significant. Although my understanding is there were all sorts of religions going on in certainly South Vietnam. And there were a few people like the Montagnards who were different. So I'm not sure. It seems to me that you know, South Vietnam, that represented a nation, or Vietnam represented a nation, much the way.
Well, the reason South Korea is so interesting is because it's South Korea.
Yeah.
You know, it divided Korea into two bits, and the South bit worked big time. You know, that's been a success, hasn't it, that country?
Yes.
And I, it makes me want to find out if there were major differences between the politics of South Korea and the politics of South Vietnam, or to put it another way, the politics of Korea and the politics of Vietnam.
They seem to me to be awfully similar.
Mm.
In that they are a nation, there's no democratic tradition. Therefore, you tend to get strong men. But the fact that fact did not stop success in South Korea. I'm not quite sure how significant the South Korean army was in the Korean War. I don't know. I'd like to find out. But if it wasn't, that's even more interesting, I'd have thought.
Well, even more like South Vietnam, in that case.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you sound as if you've said all you have to say for the moment.
Yeah, I think I probably have, actually.
And I think I have too.
Okay, well, we'll stop there.